Thanks for being with us, everyone, tonight. We'll be opening the phones in a moment or two. Our guest is Colonel John Alexander, talking about a whole array of threats, geopolitical changes that are sweeping around the globe and could represent a direct threat to our way of life. John, you delivered this talk in Las Vegas to this group of former intelligence officers, people who presumably would know, you know, a lot of what's going on. How was it received? And I ask it in this context of, are these guys or somebody, CIA, someone looking at big picture stuff, evaluating and assessing all these different threats? Are they writing it down that, hey, we need to do A, B, and C or else?
Well, the answer is, I think, to a large degree, that's true. The response I got was overwhelmingly positive, and requests for a lot of papers and things that I've sent out. What the general comment that I get when I give this is, we've never seen it put together and packaged like that. In other words, they tend to deal with single issues, be that the environment, poverty, drugs, or whatnot. And what I've done in this presentation is pull it all together and saying, we need to step back and get a strategic look. So that's the piece that I think is missing. Let me just recap a couple of things that we skipped over last time, but that I think are the biggest issues. We talked about Afghanistan and that, and in my view, this is highly controversial, but the nation state is a failing concept. And if we look at the what are called countries throughout the Middle East, certainly throughout Africa and Southwest Asia in particular, but Asia in general, these things we call countries were generally divided up by European nations, particularly at the end of the Ottoman Empire for them. And if you look back just in your history and mine, at the countries that no longer exist and the new countries that have come into existence. And so when you say Afghanistan, is that whole area to me makes no sense where the borders have been designated. Now, the other issue that I see is the strategic vulnerability is the national debt. Now, we talked about the economy and said, yeah, there's some bad things going on. Right now, we are approaching a $12 trillion national debt. To put that in perspective, 1975, which is not all that long ago, we hadn't hit a $1 billion yet. So in the last 30 years, we've moved from 1 to basically 12, a $1 trillion debt. And the really bad news is there's an unfunded liability coming of between, conservative numbers are $56 to $59 trillion. And what that means is when you start talking about these big problems around the world, we're not going to be able to float the ship.
And what does that mean in a practical sense to our listeners, people listening to this program?
Well, it means that the older ones are not going to have as much to worry about as any of the younger people. We have made commitments, to the baby boomers and whatnot, that we're going to provide certain things. And as you know, Medicare and the whole health care debate that's up right now, as well as Social Security, somebody's going to have to fund that. And we have been borrowing for so long that is just a national, vulnerability. If I put that on top, when we start talking about what are we going to do in foreign policy, and we look at the poverty that's increasing around the world, and the population is increasing dramatically around the world and in all the wrong places. The places where population is increasing are the ones that have the greatest levels of poverty. How are you going to float that? I mentioned food in particular as one of the vulnerabilities. And remember, in 2008, there were few food shortages in many places around the world. 2009, crops are up, but the governments who provide money to feed the poor people around the world are not funding those programs at the rate that they were. So the capital outlay available to feed poor people. And we're talking, there's probably a billion at the starving level now. There's probably 2 billion that don't have adequate drinking water. How do you fix that? I mean, our traditional approach is, well, we'll, put in some works programs and help them out. I don't see how we do that without borrowing more against the debt that's already unsustainable.
You know, we always have relied on our technological superiority to get us out of scrapes. It's made us a military superpower. We command the skies. And I think and there's an assumption that it will always be that way. You would say that's not the case. When you look at...
You have just hit on the next big subject that I am going to be writing to. And you're right on target. Since the end of World War II, we have assumed correctly technological superiority. That is going to dissipate and probably dissipate rapidly. We have a problem with Americans is a disease that I call cerebral centrism, where we think we're the only smart folks in the world. Not true. There's a lot of people out there that are very, very smart. And one of the things that are happening, and particularly in the Asian countries, India and China, is they have some academic institutions coming along that are just world-class. And they have top-rate people, and if there was a big difference, I would say it is that they value education and Americans don't.
They're cranking out engineers and scientists. I don't have the statistics in front of me, but I've seen those reports before. And, we're not keeping up.
We're not. And if you look at how our school system, it's, go along and get along. A lot of social promotions. Don't want to stress Johnny because, he'll lose his self-esteem if he, gets a bad grade. I mentioned in there, two topics in particular, history and geography. I mean, we're absolutely abysmal in those areas. Translated to technology, if you go to this, even our schools, and say, who is it that's taking courses in, physics, chemistry, mathematics, things of that nature? Quite often, they turn out to be foreign students.
I know in my line of work, journalism, the networks that used to cover the world have bureaus all over the world.
Right.
They've cut way back on that stuff, primarily because Americans don't want to hear that news. They don't care what's going on in England and France and South Africa. They're more concerned about Lindsay Lohan and what she's up to and who Madonna's sleeping with.
Yeah, well, you've hit the nail right on the head. Let me, as you know, because I've done this with you, but I have a quiz that I put out. I'll put it out to your listening audience. How many people have died in Congo due to conflict in the past decade? And that does include secondary from disease and famine that has gone along with it. I always tell people it's a big number. The reality is it's about 6 million people have died in Congo, and nobody cares.
John, stay with us. We're taking our break now. We'll come back, open up the phone lines, and I'm sure our listeners have a lot of questions for you. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. We're going to the phones with your questions for Colonel John Alexander. On the wild card line, Bill in Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Bill.
Hi, George. How are you doing this evening?
Okay.
John, I have a question for you about something you have not discussed that terrifies me greatly, and that's Israel and Iran. Let me form my question. If Israel should next year, since Barack Obama has given right-wing Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, till the end of the year to let negotiations work, if negotiations do not work by the end of this year, 2009, I fear as of early next year, Israel will bomb Iran's oil fields. I hope they don't do that. I mean, their nuclear facilities. My point is, Iran will not roll over and play dead. I fear that in retaliation, they would close the Straits of Hormuz as well as use missiles to bomb the oil fields in Saudi Arabia, which means gasoline here in the United States could be $20 a gallon or more. It would bring our country economically to its knees. Could you comment on this?
Certainly hit on one of the major problems that is looming out there. I think Bush did us a great disservice when we started talking about the axis of evil. And, you know, when you start talking about all Iranians, first of all, there's an awful lot of people in Iran who are really quite pro-Western. They are not a monolithic country. Ahmadinejad is actually, it does not have the kind of influence or power that, say, the American president would have. And yet we deal with them in a very adversarial relationship. Israel, on the other hand, is very concerned, and rightfully so, because you have leaders in Iran who have said Israel basically shouldn't exist. And that is a feeling that permeates other countries in the area. I don't have a good solution. I certainly wouldn't put a price tag on what gasoline would go to, but it certainly would be influenced and influenced greatly under such a set of circumstances. But this is one of the great diplomatic issues that is facing, you know, the U.S. at this time. We have very little influence in the area, and I think that if you find Russia and China getting together on those issues, they'd have a lot more influence than we would.
Well, we have influence with Israel, don't we?
Yes, to a degree. But folks forget, you know, that while we're administratively very strongly supporting Israel, we've had a couple of incidents like the Stark and the Liberty, that, you know, where they've actually attacked American ships. So if they feel sufficiently threatened, I believe they probably would try to initiate an attack. I mean, if you want Armageddon, that's certainly an interesting start. Like I say, but our ability to intercede is going to be limited. And I think what we need to do is to get more pressure on, Russia and China, getting them to try and get Iran to back down. But the level of, vitriolic discussion that's going on is not useful.
Bill, thanks for the call. Blair in Sedona. Hi, Blair.
Hi, George. Colonel, let me preface. I served on the USS Farragut in Beirut Harbor in 1983, holding a PRP program clearance. But it seems to me outspending the Soviets in the 1980s has brought us now secrecy and compartmentalization dollars to favorite private concerns within this military-industrial complex, especially that still unaccounted for $1.1 trillion of the $2.3 trillion Defense Secretary Rumsfeld announced missing on September 10th, 2001.
Yeah.
What would you say?
I would say Rumsfeld was being dramatic at the time. Remember, he was going in a totally different direction because the date's obviously clearly important because it was before 9/11. What he wanted to do was to revamp the military-industrial complex and the relationships that they had, and I think that was very laudable. I don't believe there was $1 trillion missing by any stretch of the imagination. I keep hearing those figures sewn up, and if you know anything about the, how money works in the Pentagon, this stuff is watched and fought over, even in the black community. I do agree, however, that the degree of secrecy is unnecessary and has created a huge burden, as well as taking away, credibility from, the trustworthiness between the public and the military. And, we've certainly seen favored defense contractors get more than their fair share, and, Fat lady, I don't think, has been born yet, but is certainly going to be singing for a long time before we get that sorted out.
Thanks, Blair. East of the Rockies, Angie in New York City. Hi, Angie.
Hi. Yeah, I'm really enjoying the conversation with the colonel. And one of the things that concerns me is what you mentioned before was the debt, or the deficit, I should say. And I'm wondering why we have so many outsource subcontractors in the wars that we're fighting right now. I understand that before, like in previous wars, we used to do all that stuff ourselves. And the contractors, you know, they if you wanted to have like somebody set up the bathrooms or do the, you know, the kitchen and catering and all that stuff, we used to do it.
Sure.
Why do we have to outsource?
It's called manpower.
What do you mean?
Well, we cut the military force back. You're entirely right in saying these are the things that we used to do within the military force structure.
Right.
We used to have something when I was a private, you know, called KP or kitchen police.
Right, exactly.
We're the ones who went in and, you know, did all the menial work. You had cooks who were part of the military. As the force structure came down, we started saying, well, we can take this away. It's what the tooth-to-tail ratio is something that they try to address. A lot of this got into, you know, when we started better business practices, and they started running the military as if it were a business. And many of us would argue there's a great deal of difference between being a manager and being a leader. And the problem is just fundamentally one, you haven't got enough. There's simply not enough people in the military to do all of those tasks.
I would think it's kind of expensive to hire these people at companies like Blackwater.
Yeah, well, it certainly is. Now, but what you do is, of course, amortize life cycle costs. And by that, I mean, if I have somebody who's in the military and going to be there for a career, then I'm starting to look at a 20-year commitment. One of the biggest issues that's hit, you know, in like Iraq, they simply did not understand what they were getting into. If you remember, the original cost figures were in hundreds of millions that it was going to take to run the Iraq war, not hundreds of billions, which we ended up spending. Grossly have underestimated what we're getting into. And the biggest issue, and I'd like to digress just a bit, and that's going back to the strategic issue. What we don't have, or seem to be lacking, is strategic thinking. And that is, we talked before about, you know, the countries that shouldn't exist. All these countries throughout the area really shouldn't exist. I think we need to go back to square one and start evaluating as what are the strategic outcomes that we want to see, as opposed to dealing with each of these problems as eaches, which is the way we, you know, tend to do it. And but what this caller just mentioned, and by the way, it is not the deficit. The deficit is the amount of money that is out of, you know, the annual budget. The thing that's killing us is, in fact, the national debt. The deficit influences the rate of hemorrhage in the debt, and it would be a good thing to get that under control, but that doesn't solve the problem.
You know, I worry, and, you know, we get a lot of different kind of political viewpoints expressed on this program. I worry that our country is too divided. The political paralysis that we've seen now, it's like Obama, he can't get anything done. And it was the same thing true for George Bush. There's the divisions are so deep and the animosity is so real and pervasive that it's hard for anyone to get anything done.
Yeah, I know. You're right on target there. I don't know how to correct that. There is an interesting book by Samuel Huntington, who died recently, but it was he's the one who wrote The Class of Civilizations. He was at Harvard. But he wrote Who Are We? It was written in 2004, and it was written to Americans. And his bottom line is, we don't know who we are, but we're certainly not who we used to be. And part of the problem is that if we don't figure out who we are and how we're going to cooperate, and then get back to the issues that you're mentioning on, you know, the political, you know, circus that goes on in Washington. I don't know. It does not paint a pretty picture.
John, stay with us. We'll come back to the phones. A lot of folks want to ask questions of you. Stay with us, everyone, for more Coast to Coast AM. Thanks for being with us, everyone. You know, if you're like me, you grew up in an era where America was the sort of the beacon to the world, the good guys, the example, the ideal. And it's hard to come to grips with the idea that it will not always be that way, that maybe we're frittering away our standing in the world. And these are difficult issues to grapple with, for sure, and difficult realities to accept. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Colonel John Alexander, and we'll go right to the phones and get to as many of your questions as we can. Stay with us for more Coast to Coast AM. We're going back to the phones with your calls for John Alexander, and I hope before we wrap this up, John, that you can tell us that there is some sort of bright spot or light at the end of the tunnel, or at least some sort of cause for hope, but we'll get to that toward the end of this half hour. Jerry in Houston on the wildcard line. Good morning, Jerry.
How are you, George?
Okay.
Good. Colonel Alexander, it's a pleasure to hear you.
You got a question?
Yes, sir, I do. I'm a lieutenant commander, United States Navy, retired, ex-Special Forces, head of a group of a unit based out of London of contract soldiers. Unfortunately, there are many other groups that give us black eyes when we go over there. Most of our contracts are private contracts to protect or control specific areas, either when we were in Iraq or now it's more Afghanistan. There are many times that we interact with the military. When we do, we have specific instructions to all of our unit members, whether we're doing independent ops or whether we are working directly with, to fall under the chain of command of the units that we're working with. Not all of the contract soldiers that come out are like Blackwater soldiers that just run freely and do whatever. We get our people directly from either discharged or retired military groups, many with Special Forces backgrounds. So when they go into an area, they are not only combat trained, but also trained by us to do private contracting, which is substantially different. So I wanted to get your comments on that, see what your feelings are about more, if you have run into more private contract areas, private contract people who have done the job that they're supposed to do. And I'll just listen off the air.
Thanks, Jerry.
Okay, well, first of all, when I was in Afghanistan, I was there as a contractor, one of the organizations such as the one that Jerry just mentioned. And he's absolutely right that there are, you know, a large number of very, you know, highly professional troops. The group that I was working with, at that time, there were probably about 10 of us, all retired colonels, and working under very strict supervision, both internally and externally. We reported specifically to, in that case, an American colonel who reported to an American general. As we know, that because of some of the incidents that have occurred, particularly when, you know, shooting has taken place, you're all familiar with the lawsuits that came out as they've tried to arrest people, and has happened both in Afghanistan and in Iraq, certainly gives folks a black eye. But again, you're back to the fundamental issue is we just don't have enough forces in, you know, the U.S. force structure today to handle the missions that are being assigned. Therefore, you know, you bring in contractors. Their expertise varies from extremely skilled, highly proficient, to how the hell did he ever get in the door?
I guess the fact that, as you said, John, there are so many of these contractors, we don't realize how many are serving and doing the job for our military in support of our military. The fact that we haven't heard about more black eyes, more incidents, suggests that a lot of them are doing serving honorably and doing a good job.
That's absolutely correct. I'd say the vast majority, and particularly, again, you're back to the troops on the ground, are doing a superb job and doing exactly what they were, you know, brought in to do. And the ones that come out of the military in general have, you know, a high degree of proficiency in specific skills that are needed in that area at that time.
Jerry, thanks for that call. We're going west of the Rockies. Ryan in Washington. Hi, Ryan.
Yes, this is going to dive off. I'm not in the military. I'm not in intelligence. So this is going to dive off into the kind of a bit of the strange and unexplained. It might be more suitable for the next hour's guest. But when Iran test fired those two missiles, one missile was interfered with, and with an unknown object that fired something at it. And a lot of people are saying that that was a cloud or that was a shadow of that missile. However, if you zoom in on it, if you look at the video yourself and you zoom in on it, it's very clear that you see an object approach it and fire something at it, circle it, and then take off. Now, the question I have for you is, this video is available all over the internet. It was on Fox News. It was on several other stations. This is not like the Big Sur incident when the video was confiscated and nobody was able to see it. Now, my question for you is, if this was known worldwide, do you think these countries, even though Ahmadinejad is not playing with the full deck of cards, do you think any of these countries would be spending all their money developing nuclear weapons if they realize that they're dealing with, they're not just dealing with Americans, they're dealing with something else that's interfering with that? And if there's any intelligent people, I know there's a lot of intelligent people listening that might not know or might still be questioning whether the UFO situation is real, I highly recommend watching the movie I Know What I Saw, which is on tomorrow night on the History Channel again from James Fox, and you can make up your own mind, and I'll just take it off the air.
Okay. John, do you know anything about this, something interfering with a missile test?
Frankly, no. As you know, I've been tied up for the last week or so, and so I can't speak to that. What I have said, if you want to venture off into that area, and I issued the $10 trillion challenge a number of months ago to people who believe that there is something outside that's going to come and save us, you know, we sent the message out, you know, the rescue ship didn't arrive. We'd better get to bailing.
We should mention for the audience that may not know you well that you have studied the UFO issue. You are interested in it. You don't accept everything that floats around out there, but you think that there is a legitimate phenomena worthy of inquiry, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that those UFOs are real. Where I have problems are when we get into the conspiracy theorists that somebody's either reverse engineered it and we're flying stuff around, and you know, the great they are going to come in and protect us. I am, like I said, we sent out the call, the ship didn't arrive, so it's our turn to bail.
First time caller, John in California. Hi, John.
Yeah, thank you, George. Thanks for taking my call. And Colonel, I want to thank you for your service.
Thank you.
And my question is, I'm a scientist. I graduated from University of California. I'm not going to name my town. I'm east of San Francisco. You can probably figure it out. I work for a research laboratory. My question is, I want to get your – it's a strategic question. Let's look out 10 to 15 years on the use of a nuclear weapon as an EMP device. That's an electromagnetic pulse. A lot of people worry about that. I worry about it. Do you worry about it?
Well, I think everybody, and it doesn't take nuclear-driven EMP. There's a number of ways to get out, you know, pulse power. The problem, there's a real financial issue here, and that is that if you want to protect even the critical infrastructure, and you can harden against EMP, but it adds a great deal of cost to end items. I'll give you an example. Military communications, you know, 95% of the military communications go through civilian satellites with civilian systems at some point, which are inherently not hardened. So the potential for use of this is, frankly, very high, and it's a very scary proposition.
Thanks for the call. Paul in Vancouver on our wildcard line. Hello, Paul.
Colonel, what are the political possibilities or ramifications for this shrinking ice cap in terms of terrorism or other things? And what's the risk that China will become a failed nation state?
George, can you give me the question? I didn't follow.
Paul, could you repeat that? I wasn't quite sure.
There's two questions. One is, what's the geopolitical implications of the shrinking ice cap in the Arctic? And the second one is, what do you think is the chance that China may become a failed nation state?
That China will become a failed nation state?
That's right.
I don't think they will. I think you may see them subdivide a little bit differently, but the Chinese form of government, particularly now, is very centrally driven. I do not foresee that. The second question, however, is you've hit on, the key environmental issue. There are huge implications about the polar ice cap melting. Two include, one is the rise in the level of the oceans. And if you look at what happens around the world with even a few inches, let alone a couple of feet rise on the oceans, it starts to inundate large areas, particularly in Southeast Asia, where you have very large populations, which turns to migration of potentially hundreds of millions of people. So that's huge. The other issue up north is that it changes shipping routes, and the shipping, say, between Europe and Asia is cut down by thousands of miles if you go across there. And we do anticipate that the Northwest Passage will be open, very shortly for shipping. The other piece is there's a lot of minerals up in the Arctic region, and there's going to be competition for who has the mineral rights for mining. Russians have made some pretty bold claims out from substantial distances. I think there's going to be a lot of competition to see who owns what up there.
And we're sort of on the sidelines?
Well, no, we're actively involved. But you see, with Russia, it's on their borders. The same with Canada. You have Russia and Canada being, having the primary borders across there. We will intercede. We're certainly concerned about the issues. I think I showed the chart there. I know that in 2007 there were predictions as to how far the ice was going to recede in 2008, and the reality is that it receded even more than any of the predictions that had taken place. And if you look at what's happened just within the last decade with the polar ice cap in particular, you see some breaking up in the Antarctic as well. Big geopolitical implications.
I know that global warming, that term is a political hot button, and there are different widely varying opinions about its reality, but yeah. You're suggesting that in intelligence assessments of our planet that there is global climate change, whether you call it
absolutely.
Global warming or not.
Absolutely. We can argue, and I have seen some very thoughtful debate about what causes it, but that you are seeing major changes in environmental issues around the world is just, incontrovertible.
All right. I'm told that Paul in Vancouver, that was not Paul in Vancouver, that Paul is still holding, so we'll go to him now. Paul?
Yes, this is Paul in Vancouver.
How you doing?
Thank you, Colonel. I appreciate your information. I have a comment and then a question. I might start out by saying that I'm also a Vietnam vet. And while I was in Vietnam, we had a civilian construction company, RMKBRJ, which I'm sure you remember. But I think it needs to be pointed out that the BR in the BRJ is Brown and Root, which is a subsidiary of Halliburton.
Right.
And it's the same entity that is currently operating in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right.
And then my question was, do you believe that if we legalize all these quote-unquote illegal drugs that are being smuggled in that supports terrorism, that it would take the profit incentive out of it for them and leave them all holding the bag?
Well, yeah, you've hit on a hot button that I have discussed many times. It's politically incorrect, but I think that's exactly what you have to do. If you're going to try and manage this, the profit that you mentioned from what it costs to make cocaine, 98.5% of the money between the transportation and the street price is profit. 98.5% profit. I happen to know that within the last week, we have intercepted over 10 tons of cocaine, not kilos, tons of cocaine. And the point is that the market availability and street price barely fluctuates, even with a huge amount. And I've seen at times where we've had hundreds of tons that have been intercepted, meaning you just can't get there from here. We have spent $700 billion, about the same amount as we've spent in Iraq and Afghanistan on the war on drugs, with, I argue, very little return on investment. And by the way, there's a judge in California who puts that number at $2.5 trillion. I think if people looked at what we've spent and for what purpose and what we've recovered from it, I think there'd be some real serious questions. But nobody ever addresses that.
Yeah, you look at the effects, what's happening in Mexico and what it means for us in the long term, security-wise. Wow.
It's a huge issue, and it's all profit motive. By the way, one of the things that DEA, you know, has changed in the United States, the primary focus is not on, you know, cocaine and heroin, but is now shifting to prescription drugs, because we've had more deaths from misuse of prescription drugs than we have from illegal drugs.
John, is there a bright spot? Is there cause for hope? You know, can we stop the slide, respond to these challenges?
I'm not sure. It is something that no single nation, and that includes the United States, can handle. I mean, the issues are that big and, you know, will cost that much. I'm going to put a plug in because I happen to know who your speaker or your guest is next week.
Sure.
And I think with Jim Channon, if you want a guy who is optimistic and understands the planet and those sorts of things, I think he'll probably be a little brighter than I am. And it's going to be quite a treat for the your listeners.
Well, we should explain this new movie. The promos have started running because the men who stare at goats.
Yeah.
and there are some people who think that you are part of the model for the character played by George Clooney in this movie.
Well,
right?
Certainly the pieces that I've seen would fit that. And Jim Channon was a technical advisor, and that's certainly what he said. And, of course, they have updated. Now, in the book, it is unambiguous because we were mentioned by name. But, of course, the movie is, you know, the book was based on about 5% reality and 95% hokum. And the movie bought a cute title, so I'm still waiting to see it come out. It is going to be quite a comedy. But for sure, Jim Channon is the guy who created the First Earth Battalion, which is called the New Earth Battalion in the movie.
And he will be my guest next Sunday night. John, you're not packing your bags and heading up to live in a cave or anything, right?
No, but Victoria on Times talks about what's going to happen in 2012, and I suspect we're still going to have to go to work the next day anyway.
Thank you, John Alexander. Thanks for being with us. That was a very enlightening conversation, very disturbing, and I appreciate you being our guest. Up next, Witness to Roswell, Don Schmidt, talking about the granddaddy of UFO cases. Stay with us, everyone, on Coast to Coast.